It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. John Van Hammersfeld's work is instantly recognizable. Whether it's the album cover for the Beatles' Magical Mystery Tour, or the Rolling Stones' Exile on Main Street, or concert posters for other music legends. The exhibit Era of Cool, The Art of John Van Hammersfeld, at the Westmoreland Museum of American Art, concludes October 20th. It includes a selection of his album covers, poster designs, drawings, mural designs, and paintings. John joins us in studio now. John, welcome to the Confluence.
Yeah, how about it?
When someone mentions the movie The Endless Summer to me,
yes,
the first thing that comes to my mind is not a scene from that movie, that documentary about surfing, but rather the poster you created with its vibrant colors.
Yes.
So what inspired that poster?
You know, I had been working in that medium at art school, black and white, high contrast photographs with color. And, you just had so many opportunities. I was the art director of Surfer Magazine. And I would only do the front page in the magazine. But when I got this job, I could actually bring that over and no one would really mess with me. So it was like an open poster deal that I could do.
So this poster and working for Surfer Magazine, was that sort of really exciting for you because you
are a
surfer?
I was only like 21 years old. I was taken seriously.
But you were a surfer. Have you had a lifelong love of surfing?
I was a famous surfer at that time, you know, mm-hmm. and I'd gone to art school for about a year and a half or so. And I was given this opportunity where I could start my own magazine. And then once Surfer found out that I was taking their advertising, then they got a hold of me and hired me. So I went from a student to an art director just like that.
I mentioned, I alluded to your work for many album covers for many great artists. Would you say that different art forms, like music, like graphic design, film, they're sort of all connected?
It's media, you know. So then when you start doing something relative to art with them, the record business per se, you know, the person who actually makes the tune, you know, or is the act is considered an artist. So from the promotional end of it, to come over, you're a designer. But what I was able to do is be an artist and a designer. And right. So the way my studio was set up, I could do all kinds of different things. And the thing about album covers is that because of the charts, everything is going up to number two, number three, number one, right? And if it gets to number one, they don't want to ever see you again. So you have to become very inventive. Mm-hmm. And that's why I had these variations going on and doing 300 album covers over a 17-year period of time was quite amazing.
The museum CEO calls the exhibit Eye-Pleasing Alchemy. How do you feel the exhibit pulls it all together?
Well, you know, it's the hand, you know, and the mind of a person who persisted and went through all these different clients in different decades. Mm-hmm. And so the work has a consistency to it because it was sort of plugged into the culture at the same time.
Does one form of art inspire another?
I don't know quite what you mean.
Well, say, does music inspire the visual? Does visual inspire the audio?
Everybody asks that question. So how do you solve the problem, you know, of making an album cover? And I said, well, you just go and do it, you know. Mm-hmm. You don't even talk to the group in many cases. You just talk with the manager and the mm-hmm. and the record company. Mm-hmm. And it's really about what the look of the album than it is the content of the album.
Right.
So, you know, everyone says, so it doesn't look like the music. I said, well, it's sold out.
John, what inspires you?
What inspires me?
Whether it was decades ago or today, what inspires you?
You know, my gym teacher or my gym, person there always says, so how are you doing today? And I said, everything. It seems that everything is an inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
As I move through the day and find all these different things. Mm-hmm. So it's just being active about seeing and questioning, and through the questions you invent And through the invention, something comes out of that that's graphic.
You became immersed in the rock and roll scene at about the same time that you were hired as art director for Capitol Records. How did you get that gig?
You know, it was really crazy. So The Endless Summer became a hit in New York in 66. And so there I am in 67 at the Tower, and someone, Ed Ruscha, asked me if I would go over to Capitol Records and see if I could get a job there. And so being there, I had the poster with me, and I pulled the poster out. And the fellow I was talking to, Mr. Osaki, he reached over and picked up the album cover. So all of a sudden, instantly, I was an album cover designer. So then he sent me upstairs to Brown Meggs. And then Brown Meggs, as I was coming through the door, he says, "You're going to work for me, and you can't turn it down." Yeah, what I had to understand at one point, all of a sudden, you know, The Endless Summer as a cultural symbol was as important as the Beatles.
Hmm.
And that's why they hired me.
So what was that scene like for a graphic designer at the time, mid-late 60s?
Well, again, you know, there I was as an, you know, a surfer art director, you know, and all of a sudden I was an art director for the CRDC doing the Beatles. You know, so Sergeant Pepper went through my desk, and, you know, the Magical Mystery Tour went by, you know, and the Beach Boys, and, you know, it just went on and on. It's quite amazing.
Our guest on The Confluence is artist John Van Hammersfeld, whose iconic art for album covers and concert posters is on exhibit through October 20th at the Westmoreland Museum of Art. John, as you were creating the art for, say, the album cover of the Grateful Dead's Skeletons in the Closet, or a concert poster for Bob Dylan, were you listening to the music as you were creating it?
No.
Okay.
You know, let's say in the culture at that time, and everyone was roughly the same age, you know, you knew all the songs, and it was all right. Part of the social kind of blanket world that you worked in. And so, you know, with Dylan, I had probably spent, you know, years listening to Bob Dylan, you know, years listening to the Stones, you know. When I met Mick Jagger and Keith Richards on the couch there at the mansion, you know, it was like they were amazed at who I was, a surfer, The Endless Summer.
You did assignments for many and various music artists, and just listed a handful of them, including, I'll add in, Jefferson Airplane, Cream, Blondie, The Stones, Jimi Hendrix. How much input in at all did the artists have in what you were producing for their album cover, for their concert poster?
Yeah, so I learned how to work with them, you know, and I would ask them if they had any symbols that they could tell me, you know. And so on the Jefferson Airplane, you know, Gracie said stumps, and another one said, you know, bust, and another one said bomb, and, you know, it was just like ridiculous like that. So I went with Mr. Thompson, who was the manager. I asked him if he would get a bomb photograph for me from the U.S. File. So that came, and then Hero, you know, had shot some pictures of the band for Harper's Bazaar. So then I took that and I put them together. And then putting them together in these five people inside this, you know, atomic bomb blast, you know, it was the baby boomers, right? It was like perfect as a solution. They never got it. And so they got really mad because I charged so much money. I wanted $9,000 for it. And so everybody got really upset, you know. So then from there, they went on tour, and then I happened to be in New York at the, you know, probably 4 or 5 months later, and they asked me to come over to the Fillmore East, you know, to take a look at the band, you know. So, you know, Bill Graham meets me at the ticket area there, and he takes me in and sets me down in the seat right in the center of the audience, you know. And then as the band comes on, they turn the strobes on the audience, you know, so that your eyes just went black, you know. And then as they turned the lights off, then it became red, and then it looked like a bomb, and they had a and then they came out playing, you know, Crown of Creation. So they assimilated, and there was a light show that went with it. They were very, very delighted. So,
did you ever get into a situation with a musical artist? Maybe you said, look, you're the musical artist. You're the expert there. I'm the visual artist. Let's keep it that way.
Well, yeah, with Bob Dylan, you know, we were working together and everything was going fine. You know, I had found this still of a guy with a hat on with a bullet a kind of decal on his chest. You know? And so at the studio there, the door was slightly open and the producer looks through and he sees this thing and he comes in and he says, you can't do that. Absolutely. You cannot do that. And I thought Bob would sort of go along with me, but he just shut up and he backed off, you know? And it said, this is the way this is going to go. We're just going to put the title of the movie on the cover and that's it. And so that's like, you have to run into those kind of things.
So who wins?
Who wins? They won.
Many audiophiles, they love the vinyl, not only for the audio quality, but to look at the album, the cover. Are today's music fans, do you think, missing out on that blend of the sound and the visual artistry?
Yes, really, in a way. You know, you went to the store in the 60s. You got the album. You brought it home. You know, you ripped it open. You smelled it. You know, you took it over, you put it on the turntable and put the needle on it, and the tune, you know, there's usually somebody there, your girlfriend, you know, a food, you know, a something on the wall, you know. And so there's like an environmental thing that happens, you know, is that the album cover goes with the environment of the sound, and it's like a memory. So most of the time, people will come up to me and they'll say, so what album covers you do? And I said, well, how about Hotter Than Hell, you know, by Kiss, you know, and they go, oh, yeah, I remember that, you know, and then they would say, oh, if they say you did the Stones thing, that's an ugly, you know, that's an ugly album cover. And they said, well, John Lydon didn't like it, but it worked for him.
Is there, it's the mandatory question, do you have one that you say, I have to have this one album cover. This is the one I want with me.
There's so many, you know, and then when you bring it down to like one, I'm going to say the Stones, Exile on Main Street. That was always just a lovely thing.
Right.
Yeah, it was fantastic. Fantastic meetings, you know, incredible printing, unbelievable distribution. And the Stones like it, you know, we all had a really great time with it. It was really terrific. It was like an art piece, but it didn't sell.
Mm.
And so that caused a problem, you know, and it cost more. It was like just to make the package alone was like $1.35, something like that. And a normal package was like 90 cents. Mm. So the company was upset. The stores were upset. But after all of that, you know, after issuing it year after year and decade after decade, you know, it's their best album.
You are applying your creative talents today through murals and public art. What do they allow you to do to express?
It's an open problem. Yeah, it's great. You know, it's a cultural event to them. So whatever you do, you know, fits the problem. Mm-hmm. So let's say I did this big tank for the DWP. It was like 510 feet around, and then the mural was like 30 feet high, and then I broke it up into 10 foot pieces, 30 feet long, and there was like 51 of them, you know. And so I, when I was going through the meeting, I wanted to do it more simple and abstract, you know. So the mayor of the city says, I want waves. So the waves had to become the feature of it. And that was really the only one I had trouble with. Or it wasn't trouble. It was like, okay, I'll do that, you know, I'd love that. So I've done probably about 10 murals with waves in them, which is very unusual.
You're still working with artists today here and there. For example, the Gaslight Anthem's 2014 album, Get Hurt.
Do you have a preference between murals, album covers? It's just two different extensions of your
creativity.
Well,
it has a lot to do with the drawing, you know, and the drawing doesn't necessarily fit into the album cover business. So the murals and posters and prints, which are more artful, seems to be what I continually do. I don't get very many, at this age, I don't get very many album covers because I'm just not in the scene. I'm not down there at the discotheques or the, you know, the bars and whatever, and taking the drugs and going from one place to the other.
So we have several days left for the exhibit at the Westmoreland Museum of Art. What would you like visitors to see and take away from seeing a great collection of your creativity?
Yeah, there's just a lot to see there. You know, the album covers, there's 40 of them. You know, there's the fine art sort of prints, you know, and the posters. It's just like a really great sort of walk around 60 years of work. And you kind of leave inspired. So, you know, that's what I want.
The exhibit, Era of Cool, The Art of John Van Hemmersveld at the Westmoreland Museum of American Art, concludes October 20th. It features a selection of his album covers, poster designs, drawings, mural designs, and paintings. John, thanks so much for joining us today.
No, thank you.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence, Pennsylvania has seen its first death from a mysterious vaping-related illness, which has claimed the lives of 18 people nationwide. A local doctor is testing out whether flat fees are better than insurance for medical services. Plus, the Supreme Court returned to the bench this week and is expected to hear a number of big-name cases on issues like abortion, civil rights, and gun control. Find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of the show on our website at wesa.fm/confluence. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
Ray Charles began making music in the 1940s in Jacksonville and Orlando, playing the piano for other people's bands. By the end of the decade, he headed north to Seattle, hoping to strike it big on his own. He scored his first national hit with Confession Blues in 1949, and throughout the following decades, Charles recorded many more hit records in jazz, soul, and even country. His influence can hardly be overstated. However, Ray Charles didn't earn his first platinum record until this day in 2004, when Genius Loves Company reached over a million in sales 4 months after his death. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spihar.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pennsylvania has reported its first known death from a mysterious vaping-related illness that damages a person's lungs. Joining us on the line from Harrisburg is reporter Brett Schultes, who covers health for WITF. Welcome back to the program, Brett.
Hey, glad to be here, Kevin.
Brett, what did State Health Secretary Dr. Rachel Levine say about the person who died and how many other cases there might be?
Yeah, and it's important to remember that Dr. Levine is protecting people's personal information, so we never get quite as much information as we might like on any one case. We do know that the average age for cases of this vaping-related illness in Pennsylvania is actually people in their mid-20s, so these aren't necessarily people who had been long-time smokers who then transitioned into vaping, who might have, you know, a whole host of lung ailments. They're often people who may be young enough to have never smoked and just to always have vaped. But to break down those numbers, as you say, one death, it gets a little tricky because the state has reported 9 cases and another 12 suspected cases to Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. So those are cases where they say, yes, this has all the hallmarks of this condition. Mm-hmm. But then there are another 63 cases that are suspected that they haven't bothered to report to CDC yet because maybe it hasn't risen to the certain standard of reporting. So, we're talking about more than 80 people who may have this in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm. According to the CDC, at this hour, we now have 21 deaths nationwide, nearly 1,100 people ill in 48 states.
Have the health officials indicated that the known and suspected cases are concentrated in any one geographic area, or are they spread across the state, or do we know?
When I was talking to Dr. Levine, she indicated that initially there were two clusters to some degree, but as she pointed out, those clusters were just, you know, Pittsburgh and Philly, where there are more people. And so I think if you were to ask her that question today, she would say that, and this is what she said to reporters a few days ago, that at this point it seems to be distributed all across Pennsylvania. And so to be clear, we can't implicate, you know, one small, you know, batch of products in one particular location
right.
as the cause of this.
Right. So how are they determining whether it's a case of this vaping illness? Is it interviews with the patients? What?
These illnesses are really serious, and the people who have them are in the hospital. So, you know, it's not like someone comes in and says that they don't feel great and they run a couple tests. These are people who are in the hospital. Some of them are on breathing apparatus, and some of them have even been put, my understanding is, in things like medically induced comas. So the way it presents is as what Dr. Levine described as a chemical injury on the lungs. So it's not a infection.
Right.
It's something that looks more like a chemical interaction.
Almost like an injury, I guess, to the lung.
Yeah, and the language has been a little bit back and forth. You know, they are describing it as an illness, but you're precisely right. Sometimes when we think of chemical exposure, we tend to almost think of that as an injury rather than an illness.
Mm-hmm.
But right now they are calling it a vaping-related illness or vaping-related disease.
Right. Although health officials have not announced a definitive cause, they seem to be pointing their fingers at certain products, aren't they?
That's right. And I think it is important if we're having a conversation about the safety and risks of vaping to keep separate two different things. And this is something that people in the who are in the business of selling things like Juul and e-cigarettes have also pointed out. And I think they're absolutely right. You know, vaping has been not that I'm an advocate of vaping or smoking. I think, you know, they're both very bad things to do, for what it's worth. And I don't know that, I think the more we see about vaping, the more research we do, we're learning that, I mean, there was a study that just came out within the past couple of days, a small study that showed mice exposed to e-cigarettes were developing cancer in much the same way that they would if they were, you know, smoking cigarettes.
Right.
So anyway, that's one conversation to be had about the risks of vaping. And I think this is bringing that to the fore and making it get more scrutiny. But yes, let's be clear. Vaping's been around and legal for over a decade. So why now? Why all of a sudden? And that's where health officials seem to be honing in on illegal THC cartridges. So this would be something that you would order online. It would supposedly have THC in it, which is the active, ingredient in cannabis or marijuana that gets you high. And so something in that mix of chemicals in those cartridges is probably what's causing these. So in most of the cases where people ended up in the hospital, they had reported in interviews with doctors that they have used those kinds of products.
All righty. Brett Schultes, we'll look forward to your continued reporting on this subject.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Kevin.
Reporter Brett Schultes covers health for WITF in Harrisburg. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Navigating health insurance can be a burden for patients and doctors alike. One primary care physician in Pittsburgh is bucking that system by not accepting insurance at all. Instead, patients pay $35 per medical issue. 90.5 WESA's Sarah Bowden reports on whether this business model is sustainable.
Kim Stanley shakes out a white pill from a prescription bottle and pours herself a glass of water at the kitchen sink of her North Huntington Township home. Stanley's been taking this antibiotic twice a day to treat an infected cut on her leg. Stanley doesn't have insurance. She quit her accounting job to work part-time for herself so she could spend more time with her teenage daughters.
Yes, it was a calculated risk. I'm a widow, so all my girls have is me.
Because of that calculated risk, Stanley was thrilled to only pay $35 to see the doctor who wrote her prescription for the antibiotic.
So it's in some ways typical for an exam room.
The primary care physician who treated Stanley is Dr. Timothy Wong.
I have an exam table. It goes up and down. Blood pressure machine.
The dark blue walls at Wong's East Liberty office still smell faintly of new paint. Before starting this independent practice in August, Wong had been the director of quality for Indiana Regional Medical Center's physician group in Indiana County.
After about 4.5 years of dealing with some of the insanity of the system, I was like, you know what, it is not ethical for, in my opinion, to be part of a system that was failing.
He says insurance companies routinely argued with him about what was medically necessary for patients. This meant hours of paperwork.
And I felt kind of emotionally drained and physically drained.
A 2016 study found that for every hour a doctor spends on direct patient care, they spend another 2 hours on paperwork.
Everybody wants slightly different information.
Julie Sikowski is a healthcare economist at Seton Hill University in Nutley, New Jersey. She's researched how much medical practices spend on communicating with insurance providers. Sikowski puts it at between 10 and 20% of a practice's income.
They're requiring different documentation, and they have different policies on what they're going to cover. So keeping track of that is very labor and work intensive.
Wong's business model allows him more time to see patients and generate income. And he has no staff. Patients pay up front, so Wong's practice doesn't employ a biller. And since he doesn't accept insurance, he also doesn't have a medical coder, which is a person whose job is to submit documentation to insurance companies. That's why he can charge patients so little. After contacting several medical associations, it's still unclear if there are currently any other primary care doctors that have Wong's exact business model. Sikowski hadn't heard of any.
It's definitely a niche market.
Even with less paperwork and no payroll, Wong's $35 fee per medical issue is minimal. If Wong averaged 20 patients a day, his net income would be $182,000 annually. Out of that money comes rent, utilities, malpractice insurance, medical and office supplies, taxes, and his salary. Right now, Wong says he sees about 4 patients a day, which allows him to break even.
I think the estimates are it takes maybe 2 years to get fully busy for a new medical practice. So I'm waiting, but I'm hopeful.
Out-of-pocket costs for insured patients continue to increase. And 2019 is the first year U.S. taxpayers won't be penalized for being uninsured. Therefore, more underinsured and uninsured patients might end up needing Wong's low-cost care. I'm Sarah Bowden, 90.5 WESA News.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The U.S. Supreme Court began a new term this week, and the justices are expected to take up several divisive issues, including abortion, gay rights, and immigration. Joining us on the line from the studios of KUER in Salt Lake City is the dean of the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, Amy Wildermuth, who early in her career clerked for then-Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens. Amy, thanks for waking up early for The Confluence.
I'm delighted to join you.
A new term, newly filled out, much more conservative court. Amy, what's at stake here?
So I think the question in most people's minds at this point is how quickly this court will move on all of these hot button issues that you listed. Right now, we understand that the court is solidly conservative, and it hasn't been this conservative for some time. So the question will be, what will the court take up, and how quickly will they move in a more conservative direction?
Solidly conservative, but if you count the numbers 5-4, would you say?
I'd say 5-4. That would be pretty confident, 5-4. Again, that 5 has been fairly solidly conservative in a way that we could not identify on the earlier courts that had conservative members like Justice Kennedy and Justice O'Connor, who would sometimes be more moderate. I would say that there's no real swing justice at this point. What we have is Chief Justice Roberts, who sits as the median justice.
What do you mean by that?
I mean that he's in the middle, right? And that means that he is, let's make no mistake about it, a conservative justice, but in terms of how you tally his votes. It's just that he seems to be the one justice that is possible to peel off on some of these issues, or at least may be a more reluctant to go faster on these issues. And I think that has to do with his role as Chief Justice and thinking about the institution of the court. He wants to make sure that the court remains an institution that is respected and well regarded. This is a court that will be named the Roberts Court. And so that has a lot of historical significance, and he takes that very seriously.
So is Roberts more concerned with the big picture than maybe some of his fellow conservatives? Even his own legacy?
I think as the Chief Justice, you are charged with that responsibility. It is your responsibility as the Chief Justice to think about the institution of the court. You have to be the Chief Administrator of the court. And it certainly, again, when it bears your name, right, we call it the Roberts Court, it has to have some personal meaning.
There are often alliances among certain justices. Any particular one that you'll be keeping an eye on during this term?
Well, as I've said in the past, I am fascinated by the relationship between Justice Kagan and Chief Justice Roberts. They seem to have sort of meeting of the minds, if you will, on several issues that I think has been surprising to many folks. I think it might go back to their roots. Both have some similar background. And I think they've just found that they are interested and intrigued in terms of how the other is thinking. And so you see in some of the more recent opinions a sort of back and forth dialogue between Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Kagan. In fact, some have started calling Justice Kagan the chief whisperer. And so you wonder, right, what that looks like. And I think that as we watch these really hot button cases, we should keep our eye on Justice Kagan, because I think she will be just as important. Now, that seems strange because she's solidly, in most instances, in that liberal four. But there is some relationship there that she has with Chief Justice Roberts, and he pays attention to how she's thinking and what she's thinking about.
And so she might be influencing the Chief Justice in terms of speed or in terms of outright decisions.
I think this all has to do with intellectual curiosity. I think they are curious in very similar ways, and I think they may not come out the same way on many issues, but it is clear that they enjoy talking back and forth with each other, at least through opinions. I can't speak to whether they talk personally. That would surprise me, in fact, because at the Supreme Court, the norm is that you don't engage personally. You do this through the written documents that you produce. But it's clear that they are paying attention to each other, again, given how the writings have sort of mentioned each other as they have gone along.
One more brief one about the makeup of the court. Of course, Justice Kennedy retired in 2018, replaced by Trump appointee Brett Kavanaugh. Justice Neil Gorsuch joined the court in 2017, taking over for fellow conservative Antonin Scalia. Will Kavanaugh be looking to make his mark during this term?
You know, that's a very good question. And in many ways, we don't know exactly how Justice Kavanaugh will come out on some of these issues. He was on the D.C. Circuit, which was a court that saw a lot of administrative cases, but didn't necessarily see a lot of these kinds of cases. So I think, you know, all eyes have been on Kavanaugh since he started for many reasons. And I think that will continue in the current term.
Well, let's talk about the first issue at stake. Oral arguments commence shortly regarding workplace protection for LGBT employees. Amy, this involves three cases, right? And whether sexual orientation and gender expression fall under the Federal Civil Rights Act of 1964.
That's correct. So we're looking at a 1964 statute, and we're trying to ask the question, does that statute protect gay individuals? And does that statute protect transgender individuals? And that, as you mentioned, is going to be argued in just a few minutes. And I should note that we have several Pitt Law students who are at the argument today. So it's really exciting.
So it's exciting you as an attorney. It's exciting for you as a teacher as well. So these individuals say that they were fired because they are gay or a transitioned woman.
Correct. And so the question before the court is that in that language, that Title VII language, and I'm going to quote it, because of sex, meaning were you discriminated or treated differently, quote, because of sex, end quote. Mm-hmm. Now, it is clear that Congress could change the language and it could make it more expansive or it could restrict it. Congress hasn't done so. So the question for the court is, how do we read that particular language? And for those folks who are on the side of the LGBTQ folks who are bringing these cases, they have a ray of hope, shall we say. And that is in a 1998 case that Scalia wrote, Justice Scalia wrote many years ago. It was unanimous, and it had to do with same-sex harassment. And at that time, Justice Scalia said Title VII does, in fact, encompass that. Mm-hmm. And it may not have been that they were thinking about same-sex harassment, but that is embraced within the statute. So it is, I will say to some, an irony, right, that we are pointing to a Scalia decision that would support the LGBTQ petitioners in this particular case.
Just a couple of minutes left, Amy. Is this likely to stay a question of federal law, or could it impact states?
So this is really just focused on federal law. This is just a question as to whether this particular federal law reaches these individuals and protects them. State law obviously would continue to exist no matter what the decision is here. This isn't a constitutional decision, right, that would sort of displace those statutes.
Okay. Pennsylvania is one of 28 states that does not have workplace protections for LGBTQ employees, but Pittsburgh and Allegheny County are among 50 or so local governments in the state with a gay rights ordinance. So if the high court sides with employees, then what might happen?
Siding with the employees would mean that nationally, so everywhere in the United States, right, the protections would protect those who are LGBTQ in the workplace, right? So the Title VII protections that we know that protect those folks on the basis of race, on gender, right, these protections will now protect folks who are in the LGBTQ category.
Mm-hmm. So if the protections are granted, how might they apply? Would an employee have to declare their LGBT status? Could this, in effect, maybe out someone?
So Title VII works in the following way. You have to be able to show that somebody discriminated or treated you differently because of your protected status. So what this really does, I'm going to frame it differently, right, is that if you choose to reveal information and someone then treats you differently as a result of revealing that information, that would be a violation. It doesn't require in any way that you reveal that information. It's just if people treat you differently because you did.
And any idea when the justices might issue a ruling on this decision?
Well, it's early in the term, so we always hope that they will release the opinion earlier. And I think it's possible that they will, but a lot of times they hold these blockbuster cases until the very end of the term, so the last week in June. My sense is that this is probably going to be sometime in the spring that we may see this. I don't know that they would hold this one.
Okay. The High Court will also hear cases this term on abortion access, expansion of gun rights, taxpayer funding for religious schools, immigration, impeachment, and the Electoral College. Amy, hope you're ready to join us again soon.
Oh, my goodness. What a term, right? What a year. We'll see what happens. Thanks so much.
Amy Watermuth is the Dean of the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. Amy, thanks to you.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, the war in Afghanistan is now 18 years old. The Iraq War lasted 8 years, yet more veterans from those wars died in this country from their own hands than on the battlefields. What's being done to reduce the number of suicides by veterans? If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.